It's November 23rd. Okay, it's 8:31. So let me begin. I'll respond to a few things. I try to begin the new stuff by 8:45, so we'll see how far I get. First, I'm surprised only one of you pointed out it was Rabbi Levi from Israel, who was a student in his youth at RJJ, that also precedes MTJ, that it goes back to 1903 as an elementary school. A number of you, well, let me pull this up now. Something. We were talking about this thing, Minyan Shalanu, and I did notice that they have a girls' program, although you don't see many pictures, maybe for tznius reasons. But regarding this and the whole issue of going off the path, first of all, I showed you the video last week around my Adelstein. Eli Turkel emails that it's not so simple because, despite what Rabbi Edelstein says, he says there are organizations in Israel to deal with the Haredim who join Nachal Haredi and are literally thrown out of their houses. So, despite what you saw from Rabbi Edelstein, he says that it still is a big problem there. Now, I showed you this organization, Minyan Shalanu, which is by Rabbi Abadi's son, and we dealt with Rabbi Abadi. I want to point out something else I think you'll find interesting, that the father, Rabbi Abadi, the posek, actually has a number, and we dealt with him a good deal earlier in these courses, has a few tshuvot that really focus, maybe because he's from a Sephardic background, that focus on not yeshiva people, but let's say the outsiders or the regular people, and has certain leniencies precisely in order to keep them in the fold, the sort of hashkafa, I guess, that would lead to this organization. I have there's a number of them, but one in particular I think you'll find interesting. And let me stop sharing and then open up again and share you another example. If I can get it on my screen here, here it is. You should be able to see this now. Okay, so Rabbi Abadi, is it coming up? You see it, the bencher? Okay, Rabbi, let me make I've Okay, Rabbi Abadi has a responsum in his book, Or Yitzchak, in which he explains how it's a big problem because people don't like to bench. And he says for there, for instance, they don't like to wash because then they'll have to bench. And he says it's a problem, for example, with pizza. He holds that you have to make hamotzi no matter how much pizza you have. When I was in yeshiva, they told us if you have two slices, it's mizonos. Three slices, it's hamotzi. So you need two slices, and then you can keep doing that. Have six slices if you want. But he thinks that that's a fraud. He thinks you have to make hamotzi on any pizza you have. But he speaks about the fact that people don't like benching. Because they don't like benching, they won't wash on things, even if they should be. So he published an abridged bencher. The what you see there, it's you can see my picture. It's this size. But you can also get a pocket size for your wallet. I actually got them. I got the one I have from Minyan Shalanu. A friend of mine went to get it, and people use it. He says at the bottom here, I'll enlarge it, that he says this nosach HaBirkat HaMazon is based on the Rambam and the other Rishonim. If it's difficult for you to say the whole nosach, you can use this even lechatchila. That is, it's not like in an emergency situation if you don't have time. And he says, better a little with kavana than a lot with that not kavana. So I tell you that, and I can say that with my sons, I have them just say this because with this, it's not, we say it together. It's even sometimes Friday night. I mean, you can say this every word and you can say it with kavana. So maybe others would say it's not the best thing to do, but he holds it is. And when I was in Flatbush once for Shabbos, even Shabbos lunch, they took this out for the benching. So, but this is an example of how he has other tshuva like this as well, that to look out for the people, the average person. And it's hard to have kavanah for the whole. I mean, let's be honest. When we say benching, don't we zoom through it often? This, so that's his whole point. And you can read the tshuva on Or Yitzchak Volume 1, that you have everything you need here, and if you're going to say this with kavanah versus saying the long one, where you zoom through it, everyone has to know themselves, obviously. The problem is that, as someone once pointed out to me, a rabbi actually, that if like you're at a pizza shop or something, you take this thing out, you gotta spend longer because people will think, they won't know you have the abridged one, and you'll go very fast. They'll think you didn't have any real kavanah. But so that's, as I said, that relates, I think, to what we were speaking about. Also, towards the end of the class, Rabbi Kelman, actually, before I get to Rabbi Kelman, he actually just said two things. Rabbi Kelman, the first thing he was speaking about, we talk about women learning Gemara, and he meant, we got into a little bit. I mentioned that perhaps with women studying, we'll have new insights, things like that. I want to show you something, which, let me find it here. I have so much stuff I want to show you here. We'll get to Bayard in a second. Okay, so you have all these institutes for women's Torah study in Israel. For the women, they're almost always called midrashet, which it's weird because even like Lindenbaum, which really functions as a yeshiva, they call it midrashet. Migdal calls itself a Beit Midrash. They don't call it yeshiva. I'm not sure again why, if they have a problem calling it yeshiva, but there's Drisha. Yeshiva Drisha is in Israel now, and you can see it says Yeshiva Drisha. You have all the teachers are named Rabbanit. We spoke about this phrase Rabbanit, although there are people, if you graduate, I guess, from Maharat or Midrash Harel in Israel, you get a diploma. But the term Maharit in Israel just means a woman who teaches Torah. There's no actual test or anything. It's just a Torah teacher. But that's actually like the men. In many Haredi yeshivas, if you study for a number of years when you get married and leave yeshiva or after kollel, they give you the title rabbi. So, but you notice that this would never work in America. In America, we're told you're not allowed to use the term, and they use the term rabbanit even at the mainstream places like Lindenbaum. This would be more on the left. So that's of interest. Also note that, well, first of all, they call the women Gemara Rebbe's Ramit. That makes no sense at all. First of all, Ram is not a word. Ram is an abbreviation for Resh Matifta or Rosh Matifta. So, and second of all, even if it was a word, the IT ending is the diminutive. So you have Kaf Kapit. That's, or Sak Sakit. If you say Ram Ramit, then you're saying that the women Rebbes are lesser than the male Rebbes, which they certainly don't want to say. If anything, it would be Ram Rama, like Rav Rabah, something like that. But and also notice the head of it. There's two heads. They're called Rosh Yeshiva. I guess they are Rosh Yeshiva, but I think David Eisen could correct me. I believe the rule is today that if Tzipi Livni or anyone else, Shaked, becomes prime minister, I think Shaked has more of a chance than Livni, she would be called Roshat. Roshat Memshala, Roshat Yeshiva. So that's of interest. Now, the other thing is that towards the end, Rabbi Kelman asked about, just to let you know what he's talking about, I was speaking about Boyarin, and I'll speak about Boyarin again for a minute. And he said, is that related to, here, let me show you what Heilman spoke about in this book. Who Will Lead Us? It's the story of five Hasidic dynasties in America. And you could read here about the Munkach. The chapter is called An Edible Challenge, because if you know the issue with the Munkach, the conflict between the father and son. And Bubov, there's a clash. And Satmar, there's a clash. Satmar's in the news, obviously. The rabbi mentioned it just a few minutes ago. It's unbelievable, the insanity to have a wedding, secret wedding of 7,000 people, and then to write about it. But what this shows you is something I think significant, that Satmar, despite all the talk about how we're in Golos and how we can't, do anything that creates problems with the non-Jews, Hiskaros Ba'amim, they feel like they're in America. They don't feel like they're in Golos. Not only do they have the wedding, then after the fact, they write about it basically to give the finger to the governor and the mayor to show that they don't care. If that doesn't show that they feel like they are in America and they're like everyone else, they don't feel if the Hispanics and the Irish and everyone else can do what they do, then they can be out there and blatantly violate government rules, and say, well, we don't care. So that's that. It's an amazing thing. It shows you how even with their outer garb and language, they still have assimilated to a certain extent. And then there's a chapter in here on Beyond and Kapitchnitz called Running Out of Rebbes. And so it's Beyond, BOYAN. They have a Beis Medrash Shul in the Upper West Side. And the whole story of the Beyonder dynasty, what happened was the son-in-law was Professor Breyer of YU. They wanted to make him Rebbe, but he says he's not really suited to be the Rebbe, so it's his son. And of course, when you have a situation like this, they had this in Munkach also, they have to train the young person to be a Rebbe. As for Boyarin, let me pull this up again. I wanted to clarify something. Well, here he is. Here's a picture of Boyarin, a major, major scholar, no question about it. I wasn't actually, I listened to what I said and I wasn't so clear in one thing, so let me clarify. I think I said something like he also offers, in addition to his standard writings about early Judaism, and also he wrote something on Rav Yitzchak Kampanton, the early, the late, the, I guess, late Rishon in Spain. But I said gay, what do I mean by gay perspectives? Well, first of all, he edited a book called Queer Theory and the Jewish Question. And he has an essay in there. But he wrote a book called Unheroic Conduct, The Rise of Heterosexuality and the Invention of a Jewish Man. And what his argument is that, well, what does he say? He offers an alternative to the prevailing Euro-American warrior patriarch model of masculinity and recovers the Jewish ideal of the gentle, receptive male. And his point basically is that what heterosexuality models as masculine, we don't have that in the Jewish tradition. On the contrary, the effeminate man, the studious person, that's the model. And all this, and by the way, that was the model. That's how Jews were. But from Rav Kook's perspective, that's because we were thrown into the Golos, and now it's time to return. We can have an army. We're supposed to be strong. But Boyarin's whole point is that, like in a pre-Messianic society, we're supposed to be weak. We're supposed to be studious. We're supposed to, and that's what we're supposed to be. That's passive gentility, as he, in one of the reviews of this book, it mentions that. Boyarin contends that the Zionist fight against popular anti-Semitic characterizations included an aggressive heterosexualizing agenda that sought to sever the alleged ties between Jewishness, effeminacy, and ultimately homosexuality, et cetera, et cetera. So you can read off that if you're at all interested. And finally, we have 2 more minutes. I want to get back to, if you recall, everyone, I raised the question, we spoke a few classes ago, more than a few, about this bracha, the Birkas Kohanim, where it says, Kotev Rechus Bnei Yisrael Amor Lahem. And I mentioned that Yehuda Aryeh Bodna in Italy, he explained that word Amor. Well, why do we say in the Birkas Kohanim to bless Rechus Yisrael Ba'ava, to bless the Jews with love? And he said, because the word Amor, in French it's Amor, in Italian Amore. Then because of the, he was made like joking and saying that's where it comes from. But there is something more to say about this. Well, first of all, in the Zohar, it says, and this is quoted in the Mishnah Brura, that if the Kohen does not love his congregation or is not loved by them, he's not permitted to do Birkas Kohanim. That's in the Zohar. Second of all, Rabbi Me'odin, Rabbi Meir Oded from Hong Kong, who we mentioned coincidentally in his Sefer, Volume 1, Siman Yud Daled, he goes into great deal about this. In fact, he even talks about the issue. Let's say the community hates the Kohen for good reason. Is he allowed then to do Birkas Kohanim? We understand if you hate the Kohen for Sinas Chinam, but let's say you have reason to hate him. Let's say he's a Moser or something. And then he discusses this on page 176. And one final issue about Amor. Amore. Well, as I'm looking, I can't help every time I'm listening.
Like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
So you see, amore, we all know it. It's a big deal. And yet, I think you'll be shocked by what I'm going to show you now, which I have to give credit to Shimon Steinmetz, my friend of mine, who called my attention to it. Here you have a sefer by Rafael Emanuel Chai Ricci. They pronounce it Hebrew Ricci. I think in Italian they say Ricci. He wrote Kabbalistic works, other works. He's unfortunately somewhat unusual in that before the era of the Holocaust and Chmielnytsky, and leaving aside the Holocaust and Chmielnytsky, he was murdered in Italy. So we don't have that many Gedolim who are actually murdered. But in his Sfarim, he has rhymes, riddles. And he has a riddle. Now, if you're wondering what's going on, a whole riddle about love, about amor. And this, by the way, is an example of amor, man and wife. You think that's strange in a sefer? I can show you lots of strange things. And actually, this is derived from the Gemara in Sanhedrin 7a. This is what it says in the Gemara. When one of the Amorim says, when love between my wife and myself was strong, we could have made our bed on a sword blade. Now that our love has grown weak, a bed of 60 cubits is not large enough for us. So there you have the sword. And if you read this riddle, you can, for example, it says, Hein hi ke'esh dolek b'toch ha'mayim. You know, you have to figure it out. It's like fire burning in water. All the poshim, all the sinners do it in hidden. At the bottom, lo yasekin ishirei shamayim, a pious person won't do it. The whole thing, whole description, it's a riddle. And then you have the perush, and he explains that it all goes back to amor, love. Everything he describes up there is amor. And up above, he says, hein hi bahar hamor, below har batera, better. It's from Shir Hashirim. Well, he interprets the word hamor as an amor love. And then he tells you, don't think it's strange. Valtitma heyot lashon romi. He's saying this is, it's also in Latin. Don't be trying it strange that I'm interpreting a romance word, let's say French, Italian, in Hebrew. He goes, why? Because heyot lashon romi niskar boson kodesh. We know that Latin is in Lashon HaKodesh. Why? Because there's a midrash that says, "Bedalud Lashonos Nasan HaKodesh Baruch Hu Torah." Ivri Aravi Arami Romi. There's a midrash that says that the Torah was given, which means it can be interpreted in accordance with these languages, with Latin, with Arabic, with Aramaic, and in Hebrew, obviously. So I don't know what to make of that, how to understand that midrash exactly. I think it's not supposed to be understood literally, but that's what he says. So remember amor, or amor. In French, it's amor, right? In Italian, it's amor. At least that's Dean Martin. His real name is not Dean Martin. He has a good Italian name. We now turn to the Sefer. We're in the new section here. Simon Kuf, 100, Tikkun Sofrim, page 223. And before we begin, I have to take you back to the screen because we have to look at something important here. What is that? Let's see, where is it? The Ten Commandments. Before we understand what we're going to be looking at the next tshuva, we have to look, for instance, at the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments are a problem. I mean, let's speak about Shemos now, not in Devarim. Because first of all, well, just even before we start, you read this, it doesn't say anything about ten. Right here. And if you look at it, you count it, you get to a lot more than 10. On the other hand, later in Shemos and a few other places as well, it says, where is it here? This is in Perek, right at the end, Perek 34. Yes, in so Pasuk Chaf Chet 28. It says that the Aseret Hadvarim, that he wrote the tablets, the tables, with 10 words. Not mitzvot, not commandments, 10 words. Later on, we'll get to this Dvarim, what that means. So let's get back to this then. So we know there's 10. The question is, which 10? What are the 10? Now, many of our shuls have the Ten Commandments listed. They have them on the on top of the Aron Kodesh. Often they have like on the top the circular, which is not traditional Jewish. That's that comes from art. There's no reason to assume they're like that. However, if you go to most synagogues, the first mitzvah they'll have is Anochi. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods besides me. Is that a commandment? And then the second one is Lo Yelacha. I think it's usually has Lo Yelacha. Don't have any other gods. So what about, and then the third one would be, I think the third one is Lo Sisa Shema Hashem Lashav. Don't take the name of God in vain. So what about the graven image? That's not included in the Ten Commandments. And what does that mean, Ten Commandments? Or ten? What about if I can show you 15 here? So that's the first thing to bear in mind. Second, I will show you something. If you look here in the, you see right here in the Torah here, you have the Samechs or the Peis. That's how the Masoretes divided it. So let's see here. The first one, they included all this. Anochi, don't make a graven image, don't have other gods, don't bow down to them. That's one. Two is don't take the name of the Lord in vain. Three is Zachor, Shabbos. Four is Kabed Asavicha. Five is don't murder. Six, don't commit adultery. Seven, don't steal. Eight, false witness. Nine, don't covet your neighbor's house. And 10, don't covet your neighbor's wife. So the Masoretes actually had it different, not only than the way we have it in all our shuls, they had it different than Jewish, generally, we assume Jewish tradition. Again, what does that mean anyway? If they're all separate commandments, how do you, what's the divisions? But let's leave that aside. Notice, incidentally, I said, thou shalt not murder. That's how this translation has it. I think this is a JPS. All the new translations today have thou shalt not murder, even though the King James has thou shalt not kill. But the reason they all have today thou shalt not murder is because it's not thou shalt not kill. Kill, first of all, kill refers to animals. You kill animals. And second of all, there's plenty of places in the Torah that describes the death penalty and war, and that's killing. But murder, that's the issue. Murder is unlawful killing. So that's the proper translation. Now, in terms of the Ten Commandments here, I'm holding the Sefer Achinoch here. And if you look in the Sefer Achinoch in this parsha, you can count like he counts like 15 mitzvot here. Mitzvah number one is to believe in God. Mitzvah number two is to not make any idols. Mitzvah number three is to not to bow down to idolatry. Mitzvah number four is not to worship idols in the way they're supposed to be worshipped. The second, more than one way. So we already see there's an issue, there's a problem with this. But what I'm going to focus on is not that. That's of interest in and of itself. Incidentally, as I recall, the Babylonian tradition, they divide the psukim differently. They divide the psukim, every commandment or every word is a pasuk. So when you get to the short ones, Osir Tzach, etc., each one of them is a pasuk. And the first, what the Masoretes here include as one commandment, that's one super long pasuk. But that's not the way we have it in Tiberian tradition. Okay, but the first commandment that the Sefer Achinoch has is, Anochi Hashem Elkecha, I'm the Lord your God. What kind of commandment is that, and where did he get that from? He got it from the Rambam. If you look in the Rambam, the Sefer HaMitzvos, the very first Sefer HaMitzvos in the standard translation has it, that's this, the first commandment is the Tzivoy, Asher Tzivanu L'Hamin Elohus, commanded us to believe in the existence of God. Problem is there's a logical problem here, though, and this is pointed out by Chasdai Kreskas, who only had this translation. How can you have a commandment to believe in God? Who's the commander? You can't have a commandment unless you already have a commander. So you're going to say there's a commandment to believe in God, but if I don't believe in God, then who's commanding? So there's a logical discrepancy here, a logical problem that you need to have something basic, the belief in God, that stands above it before you can have any commandments. However, it does appear that this is a mistaken translation. Thou shalt not believe, the believe in believe. Why do I say this? Well, first of all, even before getting into the translation itself, if you look in the Mishneh Torah, and this is pointed out, for instance, by Rav Chaim Heller in the edition of Sefer Mitzvos I'm holding. If you look in the Mishneh Torah, when the Rambam speaks about the commandments, he says, what does he say? Both in the, when he lists the commandments and when he has in the Mishneh Torah, he says the mitzvah is leida, to know. So in the Sefer Mitzvos, he says believe. In the Mishneh Torah, he says to know. So what's the difference? What's going on here? Well, the Sefer HaMitzvos is written in Arabic. And the word he uses is an Arabic word. And here's the word. You can see it here. Itakad. So what does the word itakad mean? That's what we're going to be dealing with here. What it doesn't mean is just belief. There's a piece in Rav Shach Avi Ezri, in which he quotes Rav Chaim Soloveitchik as Rav Chaim saying that the difference between knowledge and belief is knowledge is what you know or can prove, and belief is anything that you can't prove or can't have real knowledge of, that's belief. So you can't really believe in God. You can't prove or know, you just have to accept God's existence. That's actually, it's a very nice pshat, but it's the exact opposite of what the Rambam really holds. So as background for what we just said, now let me introduce the next, the first letter, the letter we're going to deal with here. And incidentally, how do we know that Anochi has to be counted? Maybe the Rambam, why would he count it at all? Just leave it off. Well, there's a famous Gemara in Makos that says the gematria of the word Torah is 611. And then there's two other mitzvot. Anochi, the first one there, and well, yeah, and don't have any other gods. So we see the Gemara already includes Anochi as a mitzvah. The question is, what type of mitzvah is? So number 100 is written. The question, the answer comes from this great rabbi, Rav Yosef Kafach. Rav Yosef Kafach, we had three classes on Torah in Motion. You can listen to on him. Unbelievably important, not just scholar, academic scholar, a posek on the based in Haggadah, enormously prolific translator of the Rambam's works from Arabic, Rav Sadia Gaon, the Kuzari, many other works. In fact, it was due to Rav Kafach that there was a revolution in the study of the Rambam. People really didn't study his commentary in the Mishnah because the translations are not very good. When he published his edition, here's his edition, then it became standard. Every base medrash has Rav Kafach's translation. So really, he really began a whole approach to how to look at the Rambam. The problem was, in his, and I wrote to him twice, and I only got a reply once. And when I've told people in his circle, they're not surprising. The other time I wrote to him was about Kabbalah, because he comes from that anti-Kabbalistic school, the Dardaim we've spoken about. That he didn't reply to me. Apparently, he would only speak to people about this who were close students. But one of his close students, incidentally, was Professor Tzvi Langerman of Bar-Ilan, who's an expert in Arabic, comes from Boston, but he's an expert. He was in a student of his, go to a shiurim every week for many, many, many years. I think he even completed with them Mor Nevuchim three times, because he gave shiur on Mor Nevuchim and the Rambam and Mishneh Torah and other things. They made, his granddaughter made a movie about his life, and his wife is, and him, here's a picture of his wife at the, you can see down here. They're the only couple that each received the Pras Yisrael. And that's, by the way, Rav Ratzon Arusi, who's the he's the successor of the this group, the Dardaim of Yemen, although he's not such a Dardai, but my mechutanim, well, the my daughter's mother-in-law comes from, he is her rabbi. She comes from Kiryat Ono, and that's Rabbi Rasson Arusi. But getting back to Rabbi Kafich, the problem is that although Rabbi Kafich makes a big deal about this point, that itikad does not mean believe. Because you can, people believe, just believe on faith. That's not what the Rambam means. If you look in the very first note of in the Sefer HaMitzvos of Rav Kafach's edition, he translates it that this is the command that we're commanded to know God. And in his note, he says the word is itzakad, and I've pointed out many times that it's not correct to translate it as belief, but knowledge. And then he cites the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, in the Minyan HaMitzvos, and he says, where the Rambam explained that what the meaning of belief of itzakad is, and then also of sadyagon emunot v'deyot. The word deyot there is a translation of itzakad, because remember Kafach elsewhere explains it. Because the whole point of the Rambam is you're not just supposed to believe in God on faith. You're not just supposed to say, well, I believe because my father told me, and that there's a whole, you're supposed to know God. What does it mean to know God? We can't know God in his essence, but we can know God through his actions. We can know God, we can understand properties of God. That is, God doesn't have emotions, and God has anger, and God doesn't have anger, and that God controls the world. We can learn about science and things like that. So there's even proofs. The Rambam speaks, there's proofs, not just the Rambam, the other medievals that are maybe not, they're not like mathematical proofs, but they can lead you in a direction that you have reason to believe in the existence of a deity. So Rav Kafach's point is that emunah can mean just belief. You believe because you were told. A lot of people believe. I work in a Catholic university. They believe in the Trinity. Why do they believe in the Trinity? Was the Trinity ever proven? Is there anything? No. They believe. Tertullian said, believe because it's absurd, right? No one could come up with such a strange idea, so unless it was true. So they believe. They believe on faith. The existential leap of faith. The Rambam is totally opposed to this, that you're supposed to study and gain knowledge. I'm not talking about Eisha Torah type of belief in the Torah, that sort of thing. We're talking about belief in God. The problem is, even though Rabbi Kafich expounds on this and is eloquent on it, I found that if you look in the introduction to, if you look in the his translation of the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah, if you look at the 13 principles, which he doesn't call them Ikarim in this translation. He translates them as Yesod Rishon, Yesod Sheini. In a few different places, he doesn't translate it as Deya. So for example, Yesod Ashni, the seventh principle, Nevuat Moshe Rabbeinu, V'husha Na'amin. And this is to believe that he's the father of all the Nevi'im. Also in the Yesod Hashmini, Torah Neshamayim, Hushana Amin, Shekola Torah Zonim Tzit Be'adenu, that we have to believe in all the Torah. And also at the end, he said, he refers to Emunah. The problem is, if you look at the Arabic, the Rambam uses the word Itzakad. How is it that Rabbi Kafach, who makes such a big deal about translating Itzakad as knowledge, that he himself translated these as Emunah? He writes to me as follows. You are correct. In other words, he was so busy in his translation, and this slipped, even though generally he got it right, and this had slipped, and he said, this is how it corrected in my version. They recently published Rav Kafich's notes on the side of his copy of his translation, and you can find what he tells me here, you can find it printed among his corrections. What it should say is the seventh, the Yesod HaShvi, the seventh principle, Nevuot Moshe Rabbeinu, V'hu Shanei Da, and that's what we should know. And the Yesod HaShmini, V'hu Shanei Da, and he gives another example of this. Point being that this is, in the, over here, I found this explanation of Itza Cod, they do point out something that's correct, that they don't like the word to know, because you can, quote, know things in your own mind which are false. In other words, Itza Cod can mean feel strongly about something, that is, have a strong belief based on reasoning. That's what Itza Cod means, to have a, not emunah, but to have a strong belief based on reasoning, but it could be mistaken reasoning. And therefore, they point out that the translation even of Deah, the Rav Kafach has, is not such a good translation. They give a different option, that it should be, where does it say here? Liot b'Deah. That is, to be of the viewpoint, or the you can't really translate that, to be of the knowledge, the opinion. But however way you look at it, the understanding is, we should know that for the Rambam, principles of faith are not faith. They're not principles of faith. They're principles of intellectual attainment, I guess you could say, or intellectual conclusions. That's the best way to put it. They're not principles of faith, because faith is often, as I said, blind faith, existential faith, faith because whatever, that's what I was told. No, no. They're principles of intellectual conviction. You were supposed to study these things and see the reasons why they make sense. This is against the whole Hasidic idea of emunah tmima, of simple faith, of not mechkar, not investigation. So that's the first thing to bear in mind, we've seen with Rabbi Kafach. And also the fact that, once again, one of the greatest sages of our time would, and you're going to hear about him on Thursday from Rabbi Zivotofsky, because Rabbi Kafach, who's also a shochet, he's one of the people who preserved the tradition of the pheasant. And I believe that Rabbi Egiv Zivotofsky will show you a picture of them shechting the pheasant with Rabbi Kafach observing there, and the special letter Rabbi Kafach wrote. So very, very important. The next letter deals with the same issue. Incidentally, if you're in the first printing, there was a mistake. The print, a typo for the heading of the first one. They put the tuf and the kuf backwards. It's akatad, but it's we fixed it for the second printing. The second letter on the very same topic is sent to this man, Rav Yitzhak Sheilat. For a long time, I didn't know how his name, if it was Sheilat or Sheilat. Someone from Mali Adumim told me it was Sheilat. I always wrote Sheilat, and then I changed to Sheilat, but then I finally got into a correspondence with him, and he told me it's Sheilat. In fact, my daughter, just last week, because they finally let them out to leave the building, personally delivered the book to him. Who is Rav Sheilat? Rav Sheilat, first of all, as I said, he's one of the most unique and great figures. If you haven't heard of him yet, you'll hear him now, because you've heard of many people who don't come near him. He is one of the Gaonim of our day, one of the unique people. He, together with Rabbi Sabato, founded the yeshiva in Mali Adumim, and they wanted a real Talmudic Lamdun, so they brought in Rabbi Rabinovich, and they gave him the yeshiva to run. Now that he's passed away, so they're Rosh Yeshiva again, but they gave him it to run. You have a parallel with what Rabbi Amital did. Rabbi Yehuda Amital, he started the yeshiva, but he brought in Rav Lichtenstein, and he said to Rav Lichtenstein, you're greater than I am. You run the yeshiva, and I'll just be a Rebbe. And Rav Lichtenstein refused to do that, and they remained co-Rebbes, co-Rosh Yeshiva. But I mean, this is like to create a yeshiva and to willingly give it to someone else. We're dealing with amazing people. In fact, Rav Sheilat doesn't take any money for teaching at the yeshiva, or at least he didn't for all these years. Maybe now as a Rosh Yeshiva because he has administrative work, but he was a Rebbe. He never took money. Instead, he worked also as the librarian because he follows the Rambam. I even saw an article as I was I was looking at the pictures. You see him here. Obviously, he goes on the Temple Mount. But the article is, you have an article here that he won this prize on one of his books. And it's a money prize, but since he doesn't take money for Torah, he put a sign up in the yeshiva that the money now subsidizes the book. Anyone now could take the book for free. He's written many, many books. If he comes from a German Orthodox background, I believe it's German. Here's an article on him. Yeah, Greenspan is his name. I don't know if it, I think it's his father. He told me his father was a student of this Sri Deish, but he's Ashkenazi, but he taught himself Arabic. He also was in the army. I mean, everything we learned in Merkaz Harav and other places. And in addition to all of his writings, I'll show you some of the list of some of them. One of his works will stand the test of time, and 200 years are going to be. You see in this book? I'll stop the share for a minute. The Yellow Book. He retranslated the letters of the Rambam from the Arabic, and also published all the letters of the Rambam with his notes. I mean, this achievement, which he did, which was published years ago, 1988, if this is all he did, it would be an incredible achievement. But look at all the other things he's written. He has a list here on his Wikipedia page. He wrote bibliographical books on the Rishonim and Achronim. He published this book, B'Torah Social Rav Gedalia, Nadal. Let me give you a picture of Rav Gedalia Nadal. I thought I had a picture. Rav Gedalia Nadal, student of Talmud Muvak of the Chazon Ish. Rabbi Sheilat started going to his shiurim and put out this work, B'Torah Social Rav Gedalia. One of the top students of the Chazon Ish. His approach was he totally accepted evolution. He has all sorts of unusual ideas, and you find it here. What else did Rabbi Sheilat publish? He translated he wrote a book between the Kuzari, he wrote Talmudic works, between the Kuzari and the Rambam, books on Ishus and Refuah and Halacha. He just came out this book, showing the connection in ideas between Hasidic masters and Rav Kook. And he also published the Hakdamot to the Rambam, retranslated from Arabic. A new edition of the Rambam on Avos. He published the Mishnah Torah. He calls it the Rambam HaMeduyak, which, the proper, based on manuscripts. He published the Kuzari, etc., a new translation. What it doesn't mention here, is... He's responsible for this work, the Shmona Kvatzim, which launched a revolution in the study of Rav Kook. When this came out around the year 2000, the eight notebooks of Rav Kook, for the first time we can see what Rav Kook really said without going through the gatekeepers, namely his son and the Nazir and Rav Charlap, in Rav Kook's own words. Everything about Rav Kook, before it was censored, you see it in the Shmona Kvatzim. And he's not mentioned anywhere, but he's responsible for it. Okay, so I turn to Rabbi Sheilat with the same question, because Rav Sheilat, he uses the word Amunah. He doesn't have a problem using it. So what about Rabbi Kafach's point? Rav Sheilat's an expert in Arabic. So he writes to me as follows. I think it's an important letter because he explains it. He says, you can write as a translation either lahamin, to believe, or to think, lispor, or to hold a position, lahachzik b'deya mesuyemet. It doesn't matter, he says. Why? Because the ikarhu, the main thing is, according to the Rambam, there's no difference between them. Because even according to the Rambam, when the Rambam uses the word Lahamin, and he brings a proof in from one of the Rambam's letters, that also is only refers to a view that you have because of a sound reason, something which you've shown the truth to yourself. Lahamin, he says, from the shoresh of the word Amen, which comes from the root of Emet. And he says, that's where you get the word like amitcha or amitecha. It's why does it have a dagesh? Because the nun dropped off. And how do you prove it to yourself? How do you establish this truth in your mind? Rabbi Sheilat says, either by a logical proof or with your chush or with you. It's a tradition from the prophets or the wise men. That's what the Rambam says in the letter on astrology. All of them are called emunah, and you can call them deya. But his point is that, and therefore he says it's not surprised that Ibn Tibbon, he translates it as Al-Hameen. And then he refers me to something he wrote in his edition of the Rambam's letters, where he says he doesn't know why Rabbi Kafach is so on constantly making this point that it doesn't mean to believe. Because even for the Rambam, belief is not what we think of as belief. It's not simply, like I told you, Rabbi Chaim said, anything that you just have to believe on faith, that's belief. Everything else is knowledge. No, even for the Rambam, the word emunah is only something which you can have good reasons to believe. It's not a mathematical proof, but good reasons. And anything that you say you believe, but you only believe on blind faith, that's not belief. The Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim explains what it means, itzakad. It's not, it's just a fantasy. It's something, it's just words. Because if you don't have a reason to explain it, then granted, for the masses, they're at a very low level. The Rambam speaks about in the Moreh Nevuchim, I think it's book one, chapter 36. It's 36 or 35, that the masses, they can't prove or understand how we know that God doesn't have a physical form. So they have to take it on faith. But the masses don't have true belief anyway. They never have true belief. They're supposed to move beyond that. But there's no simple belief on faith, for the people the Rambam's referring to at the level. Everything needs to be belief through knowledge. So for all these years, I was always pointing out that no, it's the word de'ah. It's not emunah, but now, based upon Rav Sheilat, they'll say it is emunah. You could translate the first mitzvah as emunah, but it's not just a blind faith of that sort. And therefore, Rav Chasdai Kreskas's critique, how the Rambam could count emunah, belief in God, as a commandment, because who's the commander? No, because it's not simple belief in God. It's establishing in your mind that there is a... there's reasons to believe in a deity. You can believe, you can just have faith there's a deity, but you just have to go more than that. All of us are obligated. And if you look in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the Rambam explains what everyone has to do to learn about, to give us knowledge of the deity as much as we can. And in the Moreh Nevuchim, he explains this through what he calls the negative theology, that we can't really say anything positive about God, but we can say negative things. So, I guess it's a dispute between Rav Sheilat and Rav Kafach on the best way to translate it, but it's not the only dispute. They've had other disputes as well. Okay, we have time for one more, and that's Simon Kuf Beis, page 224. And here we move to someone that we're going to see a lot about in the coming weeks, because there's like 25 letters from him. And this is the man that I believe is unique among Torah scholars today, although Rav Sheilat is also unique. And this is Rav Meir Mazuz. I'm not going to get into the politics. The Achad Party, Eli Yishai, we will get into that later, because I have a letter here he wrote me, which deals with his political failure, which is good in the end, because when the rabbis get involved in politics, it creates all sorts of problems, and they don't have time to do their writings. Rabbi Mazuz, born in Tunis, came to Israel when his father was killed in 1971 by a Palestinian terrorist. His father was one of the leading rabbis in Tunis, started a small yeshiva to carry on the Tunisian way of learning, special way of learning Gemara and Rashi, but also learning Shirei Sfarad, the song poetry and diktuk and the medieval commentators. There's a whole tradition here. He didn't publish much other than journal articles till about 10 years ago. And then starting 10 years ago, everything exploded. And every year he's published a number of works. His commentary, two-volume commentary on Chumash. Anyone who's interested in Trup and Dikduk and commentaries on Gemara, articles, his weekly Torah, these newsletters that come out. It's very different. If you look at Rav Yitzhak Yosef's newsletter, it's just on halacha, only halacha. With Rav Mazuz, it's everything. There's no other, I know there's hundreds of these newsletters, but if you want to read one, that's That's a really interesting one. So quite a unique. Around 30 years ago, I started corresponding with them. I mentioned a little bit in the introduction. I'm the one who introduced him. I'm proud of this to the Western world because I'm the first person to write about him and his ideas in English. And so I was attracted by this idea that someone with knowledge in Kola Turakua, basically, in all areas. So we're going to see some examples of this. And an expert in, I guess, what you would say, what people like him do when it's not day and night, when he's not learning Shasan post-game, he focuses on some of these other areas that I believe are, and we'll learn more and more about him. But let me just tell you what the next question's about. And as we go through and we see many questions and answers from his, you'll get a sense of the things that interest me that he can answer that very few people today really understand a lot of these issues or among the great Torah sages. What I don't have in here are the main things, because I don't feel I needed to ask him questions on halacha, which is his main thing, and Talmud study. I was more interested in the more unusual things. So what's the question? And it's relevant to what we spoke about at the beginning of the class. There's a Tosefta. It's also in the Yerushalmi, which says as follows, that it says that it's talking about conditions you can make when you get married. Like if I marry a woman and she agrees I'm not going to support her, that's fine. I don't have to. The ketubah says, yes, but if we agree not, I can learn in kolol, for instance. There have been based in cases in Israel where the woman has sued it, said the husband has to come. The woman has gone to based in that they demand her husband leave kolol because the ketubah says he has to support her. And, things are very difficult when he's not. And it comes down to, well, what about the agreement you made beforehand? But it goes the other way also, that the woman can make agreements. So what the Tosefta says in the Subos Perek Dalit is that you can get married on the condition. What is the condition? That she will support him. Okay, you can do that. That's, as I said, in many Haredi circles for a number of years, the wife will support the husband. And then it says, umalam dato Torah, and teach him Torah. So you get married, and she is the wife in the condition. She's going to teach you Torah. If you look at all the commentaries on the Tosefta Yerushalmi, they all say the same thing. What does it mean to teach Torah? It means that she's going to enable him to learn Torah by providing him what he needs. I have not found any that explain it at all differently. I don't have with me the Yerushalmi art scroll. I'm sure the art scroll explains it that way, because if you look in the, I think it's the Karban Eda, he explains it that way. All the commentaries that I found. And yet, if you look at it, what does it mean? She will teach him Torah. So my question is, is it possible to explain this according to Pshat, that she is going to, that's what it really, that this is the authentic meaning, that a man, that the Tosefta is referring to a woman who's a Torah scholar or knows Torah, and the man that she has to teach him Torah. I say that, is it possible that this is Pshat? We know that there were women who were learned. That's the first question I ask him. And he replies, absolutely, you can explain it, that we're dealing with a man who doesn't know anything, and she learns from his wife, and he brings a proof. Gemara in Sukkah says, and also it's in Brachos, it says, a curse upon a man whose wife or children need to do Birkas HaMazon for him. Because it's obviously, it means that he's in bad shape. Because if he knows so little that he can't even do benching, he needs his wife. But what this shows you is that you had, even in Talmudic days, the phenomenon of a woman who would know more Torah than her husband. And today it's not so uncommon. If you take, I just showed you the pictures, any of those, I guarantee you that Rabbanit or that Ramit and that Rosh Shat Yeshiva and Yeshiva Drisha, if her husband has a regular job, is not a full-time Torah scholar, the wife knows more Torah than the husband. We're the first generation where you probably have that in decent numbers. And you're going to have women who spent years learning in Israel to get married to a guy. He didn't go to YU. Maybe he only went 1 year. He doesn't know so much. I believe that this is, I have no reason to assume this is not the Peshat. Why do we assume that this isn't Peshat? It says them, if it wanted to say that she, helps him learn Torah, it could use a different language. It appears to me simple that the Tosafta says she teaches him Torah. And I think it's only because the commentators on Tosafta were like the last few hundred years in Yerushalmi, this wasn't studied so much. They're all in an environment, I think, where the idea that a woman would teach a man Torah, the women were all completely illiterate. To them, it was unheard of, impossible that you'd have a situation where the woman would teach the man Torah and you could have this. But I think that's the shot, I believe. The second question, I have two questions here. Hey, this is not that important. There was a man wanted to argue that Ibn Ezra, it should be pronounced Evan Ezra, not Ibn Ezra, because even though in Arabic it's Ibn Kaspi, Joseph Ibn Kaspi, who does not know Arabic, he was from Provence, he thinks it should be, his name is Evan, Joseph Evan Kaspi, and he has a whole thing on this. But Rabbi Kafich says that no, if you look in Ibn Ezra, he has a poem where he mentions his name, and if you know poetry, in Hebrew poetry, maybe in a future class we'll talk about the Ted Tnuah, how poetry works. It only works with Ibn. Rabbi Mazuz, as we'll see, is the only one of the Gedolim today who's really an expert in grammar, in Tanakh, and all these sorts of interesting things. But we're going to get into all sorts of things related to the Siddur, etc. If I see it's already 9:27, so we should stop here. Okay, let me take the questions. I'm going to get to my chat here. Malay Adumim, the yeshiva, incidentally, I think they still do it. I know kids who went there years ago, like 7, 8 years ago. They used to take American students in Canadian. They had a program. I think they still do. I can say that on my son's age, it wasn't even on the radar. Malay Adumim. I don't know why, these yeshivas go in and out of, I think together with Har Etzion, you really have to put Malay Adumim on the top of, to have Rabbi Sabato and Rabbi Shalat, as well as a number of other people there, it's really unique. Okay, Baruch says, does Rabbi Abadi have harachamans in his benching? No harachamans at all. Is the Nusach of Rabbi Abadi's Birkat HaMazon spelled out in his tshuva in the first line of Or Yitzchak? Yes, it is, as well as the halachic justification for it. So Baruch says, if harachamans are eliminated, then benching is greatly shortened, even without doing what Rabbi Abadi offered. Well, yeah, but you could have done that as well. But he gave an abridged benching, so people could say it with kavana, shortened. You could do that. You could do the regular paragraphs and just do up to Harachaman, but no, that's what he did. If you want to ask him why, you can call him up and ask him why. But he explains it. Maharit or Rabbanit. Okay, so as I said, it's it properly, if it's Rav, it's Rabav, it's Par, it's Parah. So then you said about Maharit, but it's not Maharit. They said Maharat. That's what the Rabbi Avi Weiss. Maharit is he's the great sage, or Joseph Tron is the Maharit. Now, Rabbanit, okay, so why Rabbanit? Where does Rabbanit come from? Because what's it a plural of? Rabbanit is already used. It's been used for many hundreds of years. I'm not sure why they didn't do Rabbit, or where the nun comes in. I'm not sure. We know Rabbanan, but why, how, in fact, I mentioned this a number of times, the Chida in his Shem HaGdolim, which lists all the great rabbis. He has a section there, Rabbanit, and it doesn't mean Rebbetzin. Rabbanit for him means women rabbis. It means women who are great Torah scholars. So I don't know why. Baruch thought to say that they're telling off the mayor and the governor doesn't seem correct, since the writing was in Yiddish, not English. But there are loads and loads of Jews today in New York who read Yiddish. There's lots of Satmar people who left Satmar and are now in modern Orthodox or secular. When you put it in Yiddish, you have to assume that they're going to read it. To publish something in their newspaper in Yiddish with a whole description, including pictures, and to assume it's not going to get out there. There's all these off the derech people who know Yiddish. their newspaper is in Yiddish. That's why they wrote it in Yiddish. If the newspaper was in English, they would have written it in English too. It's obvious that they didn't care, and it's a problem now because they're supposed to have a big wedding tonight in Kiryas Yoel, and they shut it down now because of that. Ellen says, Amor, the brachos levarech ba'ava. Yes, that's a fine reason for insisting that the Kohen love the people and vice versa. Indeed, that's what the halacha is. Based on the Zohar, and the Mishnah Berurah records this, that if the Kohen doesn't like the people and the people don't like the Kohen, he cannot do it, which raises the question, well, wait a second, let's say one person doesn't like him. Do they go by the majority? Poskim discussed this issue, as well as what I said, Rabbi Meir Dave, who discusses, well, let's say you don't like him because you have a good reason not for liking him. He was mechutzav to the rabbi, and he did terrible things to the community, but he wants to duchen when he comes to shul. You're allowed, that's the sort of person you're allowed to. We're supposed to love all Jews, but some people you're allowed to hate if they're Rishayim like that. In that case, is that considered a problem also, or is only if you don't hate them for a bad reason, for the incorrect reason? Why was he murdered? We don't know why he was murdered. They found his body after a few days and they brought it back and they buried him. We don't know why. Ellen says, splitting what we consider to be the 10th commandment is done by the Christians. Actually, the Catholics split it, and they have two covets. The Lutherans also, but other Protestants don't. But here we see that the Masoretes, who set up our Torah reading, they agree with the Catholics in this. And the Tom Elyon also make the short ones at the Psukim. Yes. David says, Eisen, regarding official positions held by women, the Hebrew Academy of Hebrew Language has decided that both Rosh and Roshah are acceptable for women, while the popular linguist asserts that only Rosh is acceptable, and that the mayor of your town, Eliza Blach, is Rosh Ha'ir and not Roshat Ha'ir. So we have to see the Academy's decision. So Rosh has become masculine and feminine today. Very interesting. What was my question to Rabbi about Kabbalah to Rav Kafa? Just I wanted to know about some of his views on the Zohar, but he didn't reply to me. iPad says, I don't know who iPad is, a problem with knowing God from God's action is still the cave and shadows issue. You can never know God in God's essence. That's clear. As Rabbi Sachs said, when you mix politics and religion, you get bad politics and worse religion. Yes, it's if you look at Chacham Avadi Yosef, he had just stuck to Torah. We wouldn't have had a lot of controversies and everything, and he turned people off with some of his views. Also, it's not just you, they say things that are going to offend people. You want the rabbis often to stay above. Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg has an essay in which he speaks about how it's important for the rabbi to be above politics, be above all disputes. But often when the rabbis are brought into politics, politics is a dirty business. And it's going to reflect poorly and it's going to create problems. I'll just say regarding Ravad Yosef, because he got involved in politics, and Shas party was involved with Oslo. They didn't veto it. They didn't vote against it. They abstained. So many people in the right-wing religious Zionist world began seeing Rav Avadi Yosef as like the opposition. And they had protests in front of his house. You don't want to have great rabbis where people are having protests in front of their house. But of course, if you're a right-wing religious Zionist and the Chacham Avadi Yosef is going to determine whether to give up land, then a protest is suitable, I guess. With Rabbi Mazuz, I'll tell the whole story, and he would have been the new Maran. The Sephardic world is split into two groups. You have the more the right-wing religious, right-wing political group, very close to the Chardal, in fact, almost identical in certain respects to some of the Chardals. That's Rabbi Mazuz. In fact, when he ran for parliament, they made a unity between the Chardalim and his party, and they still couldn't get enough votes. It shows you that the Chardalim really don't have much in the way of electoral power. But there's a big split between Yitzhak Yosef and Rav Shalom Cohen and the Shas party and Rabbi Mazuz. Rabbi Mazuz broke with the Shas party. I'll tell you the whole story again, but I'll tell you just a minute now. Rav Mazuz said when Rav Yosef established the Shas party, Shas was supposed to mean, this isn't what it stood for, but he said Shin, Shachor, for the black kippahs, and Samach for the kippah surgas, that they should all be together. But now, with Rabbi Shalom Cohen, there's no room for the religious Zionist, for the average Sephardi who goes to the army. After all, Shalom Cohen said that religious Zionists, he said it's Amalek. And he said a crazy stuff like, you don't need an army. All we need is Hashem. We don't need an army. So, it became an extremist party. Rav Yitzchak Yosef is not that extreme, but there's a big split between Rav Yitzchak Yosef, Rav Shalom Cohen, the Shas machinery, and Rav Mazuz, and Rav Shlomo Amar, Chief Rabbi Jerusalem, the former Rishon LeZion, who is on Rav Mazuz's side. A complete split in the Sephardic world between where your loyalties are. And this has to do with the Sidurim and the Psakim of Rav Mazuz. Rav Mazuz is trying to upshlung, to speak in Arabic. He's trying to reverse many of Rav Yosef's halachic rulings, and more importantly, his political positions, because all the years that Rav Avad Yosef was in charge, Rav Mazuz never publicly opposed him on any political thing, ever. He even refused to be a member of the Moetzes of the Shas because he didn't want to dispute with him. But as soon as Chacham Avad Yosef had passed away, then he felt he was able to say that we don't need to go along with liberal politics, and we could be more conservative. Finally, Susanna Levin says that Maharat is Rashi Tevot. Yes, it's Madricha, Hilchatit, Ruchanit, Toranit. Unlike the Maharit, where it's a tet at the end, the Maharat is a tof. The term Maharat is invented by Rabbi Avi Weiss. He created this, and some of the graduates of Yeshivat Maharat don't like the term because, again, who knows what it means. And therefore, some of them have changed to the term Rabbah, which is a feminine for rabbi, Rav. And others use the term rabbi. There's graduates of Maharat who use the term rabbi, and others use Rabbanit, and others use Maharat. Madricha or Mora. I don't understand what you're saying, Mel. That will be the last question, Madricha or Mora. We know Mora, Madricha. I don't know what you're referring to. Obviously, that's a feminine for Madrich. Oh, you just mean with the hey ending. Madrich, Madricha. Of course, yeah, those are examples. I was referring to the two-letter words, like Rav, Rabah, Par, Para, Ram, Rama. That's why I gave those examples. With that... Marat stands for what I said before. That's it's Mora. It's Mora. Sorry, not Madricha. Mora Hilchatit. Sorry, Mora Hilchatit. I forget now what I said, but I had it before. So Mora Hilchatit. Someone can tell me what it stands for. I don't even remember.
Rabbanit, I think. Rabbanit. Yeah, Toranit.
Rabbi Mora Hilchatit. Rabbanit.
Toranit.
Rabbanit, Toranit, something like that. I don't need to memorize it because it's not part of it's not part of classical rabbinic terminology. It's Rabbi Weiss's creation. And we'll see. He himself said he doesn't know whether it'll last more than one generation. He said it all depends if the women take the term or not. But he felt Ruchanit, yes, thank you.
Ruchanit, yes.
Ruchanit, Hilchatit Ruchanit, and Maharat, He himself gave smicha to a woman who went with the title, or goes with the title, Rabbah. So we'll see whether that lasts. And look, it doesn't need to last. You see, in Israel, they use Rabbanit. So what do we need such a strange title, Maharat, for? The Rabbanit, if you want to use the title, Rabbanit. In fact, I said to one of these women who uses it, I said, I don't understand why you use it, because she gave a whole talk on how equality. I said, if you want to be equal, use the title rabbi. I personally am not into the whole women rabbi thing, but I don't get it. If you really believe you're equal and there shouldn't be the difference, then you should call yourself rabbi. By definition, when you call yourself Maharat, it's like when it means you're not the same. It's just something different. And we know that Maharat was chosen because they didn't want to be controversy. It was never l'chatchila. It was always a b'diavad. Maharat. So now that that bridge has been crossed, I don't know. But that's neither here nor there. Okay, Rabbi Kalman.
Okay, thank you. I have you read it the way actually, you know, Danny Sperber's new book. It's called, I think called, I don't know, Rebbetz and Maharat. Yeah, it's like all the terms in one. All Women in Leadership just came out a few months ago, I think.
He's the one with substance who signed the first smicha of the Rabbah.
Correct. Correct. Anyways, okay. All right. Continued next week. Please God. Tomorrow, Simi Peters continues your series on Midrash, followed by Benny Gesundheit on Tehillim, triple header on Wednesday, the last of Marty Luxion's, series on biblical commentaries on Rav David Zvi Hoffman, followed by Woman and Ritual Tzitzit Part 2 with Lori Novak, and then our Haftorah class at the night. And then Thursday, another triple header, the two classes on Thanksgiving, followed by Rabbi Karofkin on Parshat HaShavua Thursday evening. So we look forward to seeing you and seeing your friends, and everybody be well, be safe, and all the best. Okay. Laila Tov to everybody.